This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hey Mason, I really need a good gift for my generic loved one. Any ideas?
Oh yeah, Andrew, I have the gift they need. If you sign up for GoDaddy's Economy Blogcast package, you'll receive 1 gig of disk space, 100 gigs of bandwidth, recording tools, and much more.
Whoa, with all those features, I'd guess that kind of package will run me at least $20 a month and be plastered with ads.
You're wrong, Andrew. The Blogcast Economy package is just $4.49 a month for 12 months.
That's a deal, and a perfect way to get your own website, blog, or podcast started.
Ooh, yeah, that is a deal. Plus, enter code MUGGLE when you check out. Save an additional 10% on any order. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
Because Laura may be walking the plank, this is MuggleCast episode 133 for February 23rd, 2008.
So last week we got a few complaints that we only had three people on the show, and nobody's appreciative anymore of the hard efforts we put into MuggleCast these days anymore. So we said, you know what? Okay, all right. You listeners are cranky. You're bugging. You want more? This week we got six people on the show and a new host. I would like to welcome, on behalf of everyone, Elisa Montfort to the show.
Round of applause.
Hey,
guys.
Yay! Hey.
Now, Elisa has connections to MuggleNet.
What are you doing, girl. Elisa?
True that.
She's a girl, too. Imagine that, yeah.
I'm one of the head moderators for MuggleNet fanfiction.
Sweet. MuggleNet fanfiction's been around for what?
Oh, God. Three and a half years. Yeah. It opened October 2004.
Yeah. Wow,
newbie.
Awesome.
And
shut up, Eric.
Newbie. 5 1/4 years here. Yeah.
So, Elisa, we're very excited to have you on. You're a friend of
all of ours. Thanks.
Are you excited? You said you were a little nervous.
Yeah. I was a little nervous at first, but I think I'm good. I mean, yeah. I'm pretty comfortable now.
Okay, good. All right. We're confident you're going to be good on the show. I'm Andrew Sims.
I'm Eric Skull.
I'm Laura Thompson.
I'm Mike Attanabel.
I'm Matt Britton.
And I'm Elisa Montfort.
Micah Tannenbaum's in the MuggleCast News Center with this week's top Harry Potter news stories. Hey, Micah.
All right, thanks, Andrew. As if anyone needed to tell us this, MTV published an article on Friday about research concluding that the Harry Potter series can, in fact, be addicting. The story notes, in a just-finished study that's being submitted to the Journal of General Psychology, psych professor Dr. Jeffrey Rudsky and two of his undergrad students at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania, report that they found characteristics of addiction in at least 10% of the 4,000 Potter fans they polled online. While the doctor discusses that the end of the series did have serious withdrawal symptoms for some, likening it to going off a drug cold turkey, he also said he chose to do the study on the end of the Boy Wizard saga over the conclusion of the hit series The Sopranos because of his 15-year-old daughter and the things she's taken from it. She's picked up guitar because she wants to be in a wizard rock band, he said. She's studying Latin because she wants to better understand J.K. Rowling's choices of names for her characters. She started reading Stephen King and John Irving because they spoke with Rowling at Radio City 2 summers ago. If that's being an addict, he's down with it. David Barron has revealed to the Herald Sun that a new scene has been added to the upcoming Half-Blood Prince film in order to remind moviegoers that nowhere is safe. Having J.K. Rowling's approval of the scene, Barron is confident that people will like it. He says, but this was brought in because Jo Rowling was able throughout the quite lengthy book to keep dropping little snippets of what was happening in the outside world. There'd be people reading newspapers and talking about how somebody's parents had been killed or somebody had been withdrawn from school because their parents didn't think it was safe. And we're making aware that the Muggle world is also experiencing these disasters, but thinks they are disasters rather than the work of Voldemort. The book is peppered with those moments, but we couldn't do that quite so easily in the film. So the extra scene comes in the middle of the film, and it just reminds us the world is no longer a safe place. Even in what would normally be considered the safe haven of the Burrow, nobody's safe. Lois Lowry, a children's book writer, has updated her online blog with information about the Giver movie. She had hoped Order of the Phoenix and Half-Blood Prince director David Yates would be able to direct the Giver. However, he has just decided he wants to do the final Harry Potter first, thereby postponing the Giver by several years. While this is not confirmed by Warner Brothers yet, it appears to be a pretty reliable source. And a new MTV Movies blog entry comments on the Deathly Hallows rumors. MTV says that a source at Warner Brothers told them an announcement was coming within the next week or two, but we've learned that MTV may have not been told this at all. Finally, reports have emerged online that 2 new actors have been cast for Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. David Leggeno will play the role of the werewolf Fenrir Greyback, and Ralph Ineson has been cast for the part of Death Eater Amicus Caro. That's all the news for this February 23rd, 2008 edition of MuggleCast. Back to the show.
Okay, thank you, Micah.
You're welcome, Andrew.
You want to do a little competition this week, you were saying? You
know, yeah, I'm feeling in a giving mood this week. So I figured what better way than to give somebody out there a chance to read the news on MuggleCast. And the way we're going to run this little competition is anybody out there who listens to the show, send in a 30-second spot to MuggleCastNews@gmail.com. And what we're going to do is we're going to go through and we're going to pick out the top five. And then on next week's show, we're going to play the top five. And we'll put up a poll on MuggleCast.com, and all the fans can vote to see who they think is the top news anchor there. And the following week, we'll have that person on the show to record the news, and that's it.
Cool. That's a great idea. I think everyone will.
I have to say, it's one of the most innovative, I think, competitions we've had here on the show. I think it's a great. It's also, you know, competition's always welcome, but I'm thinking this late in the game, you know, we haven't had one of those for a while, and this is just a brand new idea. It's shaking things up. I like it.
Yep.
So that'll be what, episode 135?
Yeah, that sounds right.
We'll play the news for whoever wins, and hopefully it's a good competition.
Yeah. Can I enter? Can any of us enter?
Do you really want to do that much extra work? I mean, isn't that kind of like what Mike is trying to do anyway? He's trying to get a week off the news.
That's true.
He'll still
have
to script it, won't he? Or will these people be in charge of scripting?
No, it's their whole responsibility.
They have the MuggleCast News Center for the weekend?
Yeah.
They do.
It's cool. You get to go to Mike's house.
All expenses
he'll
paid.
Lock you in
except
his basement.
For flight, hotel, car.
Yeah. I mean the transcript dungeon. He'll lock you down there.
Speaking of news, couple new developments this week involving the movies. Firstly, reliable source reveals David Yates is directing Deathly Hallows. This is a little leak that I'm sure Warner Brothers is not very happy about. Lois Lowry, a children's book writer, updated her blog online and with information about the Giver movie. She has a book called The Giver. Has anyone read it?
Yes, and it's so good.
I love that book.
Oh my gosh.
Would it be a good movie?
If they do it right, yeah.
Would David Yates be a good director?
Yes, absolutely. I think he would be. but well, unfortunately, doesn't look like he's going to get to. So,
well, not yet. Not yet. She updated her blog and said that David Yates has just decided he wants to do the final Harry Potter film first, thereby postponing The Giver by several years. That's an exact quote. So this is the nail in the coffin, if you ask me, in terms of director rumors, right?
Yeah. Well, it is kind of, but I mean, it's not totally official or anything. I mean, heck, I decided I want to do the final Harry Potter book or movie, but you don't seem, you know, it being official for me either.
Right. Well, I mean, what I'm saying, it looks like Lois Lowry and David Yates talked to each other a few times, because apparently David Yates has planned on doing The Giver. But in my head, I see a phone conversation going down where, you know, they're calling each other up, you know, whether it's on Skype or, you know, they got their numbers through Facebook or whatever. And they called each other up and David Yates is like, sorry, Lois. I mean, I'm going to do the Potter film first.
And then she proceeded to defriend him on Facebook.
Yes.
She wrote a nasty note about him, tagged him in it, and then defriended him because all of them have Facebook. But no, I think this is a pretty reliable source. To be honest, though, I'm relieved. Like, you know, I mean, because obviously, like, is reliable because, you know, he was going to adapt her book. She's a respectable author, and I would jump the gun. I would take this as official, or at least I would be very relieved because, to be honest, I think David Yates is very capable, and I'm really relieved. If this is true, if he's doing the seventh movie, I'm really happy with that.
Elise and Laura, what is this book about, The Giver, just out of curiosity?
Well, I read it in, like, in eighth grade, and it's basically, Elise can probably give a better summary of it than I can, but it's about a world in which people are assigned their working roles. Like, certain women are assigned as birth mothers, and you're, like, assigned to work at a specific area, and you're assigned a family unit. And mm-hmm. in this, one boy is assigned the role of being the giver, and he can see in color when no one else can see in color. And he just has all this knowledge that no one else has, and it's a very, very tragic story. Really, really sad, but really good.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the premise of it is sort of that humans aren't capable of handling all the emotions and senses that come with being human, which, like Laura said, includes seeing in color, but also hearing certain things and other things like that. And so there's only one person in this society at any given time that experiences all these emotions, including emotions like love and even laughter and hatred. And the giver is the only one who's capable of doing that. And so every time the giver sort of retires, a new giver is chosen. And so the story is following this one boy who was chosen to be the next giver, but, you know, just his trials and tribulations and whatnot. And it has a really awesome ending, but I'm really excited to see the movie.
Oh, cool.
Sounds like
too bad we're going to have to wait 4 or 5 years now. Probably longer.
10 or 12.
David Yates is blowing her off here.
Yeah.
Well, is he still directing it, or are they going to choose a different director?
Well, they could do that too, but I think I would want David Yates. I think it's worth waiting the few years if he had really sort of committed to do it, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the author has said, well, now it'll just take a more, you know, it'll be delayed a few years, because I think she really wants
it. That's how it seems. That's the impression I got, Eric, just that.
Well, they seem to have a pretty good relationship between each other.
Well, since we'll probably be directing the next Spider-Work Chronicles movie, I'm sure we'll be busy for the next 10 years, too.
Elisa, you can go on your Spider-Wick spiel / jokes in a second.
Rant.
They're very funny.
Please do it.
So, Andrew.
Yes?
The question begs, if you were a betting man, would you say that David Yates will be directing Deathly Hallows?
If I was Micah, I wouldn't be a betting man in this situation.
He would be a cheating man.
My betting skills are not on par for this news item. However, another item that we're going to discuss in a second, I can be the betting man. But another story that came out the following day was, well, MTV picked this up and went to Warner Brothers asking for confirmation. And MTV quotes Warner Brothers as saying an announcement should be coming in 1 to 2 weeks about the director. And I assume at this point, it seems like they're going to make the director and movie split announcement at the same time. Right? I mean, because both of these stories are floating around. And, you know, we heard the director split announcement is going to come in the not too distant future. And this now is in 1 to 2 weeks. So it seems like,
it would make sense.
It would.
I find that very interesting.
Yeah. Frankly, I'm very intrigued by all these, you know, developments and rumors going around. But so apparently we're going to be seeing official word about this within the 1 to 2 weeks.
You think so?
MTV thinks so. However, when I went to Warner Brothers and asked if this was true 1 or 2 weeks, I heard that they told MTV they cannot confirm or deny. So, you know, whatever. It's a guessing game.
Well, I think the bubble is ready to burst. Yeah, exactly. You know, either way, I think it's just, you know, so many. I mean, how long has it been rumor been going around, unconfirmed or undenied by Warner Brothers about splitting book 7 into 2 movies?
Right. It's been a while.
Least a week.
So
yeah.
Since I last podcasted. Yeah.
And then we found out Thursday that a brand new scene was going to be added to Half-Blood Prince. And what do you guys think of this? I mean, this is interesting. This is the first time Warner Brothers has actually ever added a scene.
Oh, I wouldn't say it's the first time.
Oh, it's the first time.
Well, it's the first time they've actually added a substantial substantial enough thing where they had to go to Joe about it and say, well, basically, but listen for their reason for doing it. I mean, when we had seen David Yates's, there was a David Yates interview, it was audio only, where he was talking about how he was going to make Book 6 into a really sort of teenage film about the romance, and here they are saying that the book has all these moments about showing what's going on in the outside world that we couldn't do that easily, didn't really translate that well to film, so they've written this scene to, you know, make up for it. I think that's a novel idea. I would love to see whatever scene they have to offer.
Well, the problem I have with this is that, to me, this says that they're cutting out Chapter 1 from Deathly Hallows. Not Deathly Hallows, Half-Blood.
It does look that way. Well, didn't they say that, Micah?
You did hit the nail on the head there, Micah.
No, they said this is going to be in the middle of the film.
That. They say this is in the middle of the film, which leads me to believe that the whole scene with the Muggle Prime Minister and Scrimgeour and Fudge is going to be cut and essentially replaced by this scene that they're making to show what exactly is taking place in the Muggle world.
Though, to be terribly honest, if you think about it, the fun in the first chapter is more sort of what has happened in the past, because not only are we getting what's happening with the Prime Minister now, but remember, she then goes in that chapter of Book 6 back to sort of all the previous times that Fudge had visited the Muggle Prime Minister, which, you know, was to tell the Sirius Black escape, that sort of thing. So she was able to do sort of several visitations of the two ministers in that chapter, and that really, I guess, wouldn't translate well to film, especially in the beginning of the film, people would be lost.
But wait, who's to say that this new scene is involving the outside world?
He says it. He said, we're making aware that the Muggle world is also experiencing these disasters, but thinks they are disasters rather than the work of Voldemort. So,
yeah, I have to read
those. Are his words. Those are David Barron's words.
Yeah, and then he says, the book is peppered with those moments, but we couldn't do that quite so easily in the film. So the extra scene comes in the middle of the film, and it just reminds us that the world is no longer a safe place. Even in what would normally be considered the safe haven of the Burrow.
And they could have done it quite easily if they just followed the first chapter of the book.
But that would have been too easy.
You're right, especially talking about the bridge collapse and all those kinds of things. They could have done that.
Yeah. Well, Elisa, you have pretty strong opinions on how the movies should be directed. What do you think of this?
Oh, man. I mean, we're not going to know if it works or not until we see it, but I sort of think that the whole premise of it trying to make up for other areas they can't portray, I think that's a little, I don't know, I'm not quite sure that I buy that. Because, I mean, a lot of the things that are in the books that were showing what was going on outside the Muggle world were, you know, the Daily Prophet, the newspapers, and then, of course, Harry seeing names that he recognized in these articles and stuff. And they've used the Daily Prophet. I mean, just in the last movie, you saw a bunch of, like, newspaper articles like, coming up on the screen, and they used that last time. I don't know why they couldn't use it this time as well. So, I mean,
I thought it was awesome.
Edgar Sims, he was on set.
Okay, fair enough.
This is the whole story behind the additional scene. Andrew Sims went on set, and they were talking about using that to pass time. And Edgar says, no. I didn't like that in movie 5, dudes.
But
you
wait,
just have to write another scene.
We're missing one huge big thing here. He says, David Barron says, even in what would normally be considered the safe haven of the Burrow, nobody's safe. I think this scene happens in the Burrow.
It has to do something with the Burrow, which is what I thought he was alluding to just now.
I think it happens in the Burrow. I don't think it has anything to do with the outside world. I think the purpose of the scene is to just show that nobody's safe, but this scene's going to be in the Wizarding World.
Quit picking on the Weasleys.
I don't know. I'm just a betting man. I don't know.
Yeah, but if something happens to the Weasleys, it doesn't really emphasize the danger in the Muggle world.
Right, but what if you're just reading into it too hard and it has nothing to do with the Muggle world?
He said it does.
That's exactly.
No, he doesn't say it does. He just says Joe's scenes show what happened in the Muggle world.
Yeah, and we weren't able to portray that, so we wrote this scene. So if this scene doesn't really make up for that, then it's just a crap added scene, and I'll be very upset.
Anyway, I guess so.
He does tend to make his own scenes though too, because like what he did in Order of the Phoenix when he wanted to make a chase through London when the Flight of the Order.
That was potentially hazardous to the. Yeah.
It was stupid, right. Is what it was.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
But I liked the rest of the movie. I did like so much of the rest of the movie. I completely see past the whole non invisible people flying through London. Though, to be fair, if they weren't visible, you know, you couldn't watch them flying through London.
It was just a cool, like, fast paced scene. I mean,
yeah,
you know, they didn't feel like explaining why
but
they're
you're
not
right,
invisible.
it was bad.
Who knows? Maybe chapter one will be in there, but when I read it for the first time, that was what I thought of. I thought that they were essentially creating their own scene to replace, you know, the Muggle and the Wizard Prime Minister meeting.
The other minister. Well, do you know what else? And this is just my final thought on it, is that, you know, we're kind of complaining that they aren't getting the first chapter, and I agree with that, and that's a problem for me. But wait a minute. I kind of like the idea, if you can't do it right, don't do it, in a way. I like that, and I like the idea that we're going to still have some really good scenes in the books that were never translated to film. I agree that the film should be accurate representations of the books, but there are some things that are always going to be better read, and I think maybe chapter one of book six will be one of those moments where it's just you love reading the book, even though there's a movie out to supplement.
I kind of agree with Eric.
Yeah, I don't really think that inventing a completely new scene is that big of a deal if it's just sort of portraying what we already know is happening in the books anyway. It's not like they're inventing huge major plot points. I mean, they're not saying Aberforth was, you know, the giant squid in Animagus form or something. They're not like putting something completely random in there. I mean,
but if he were, can you imagine a giant squid and goat?
Wow, no, actually I can't. I'm sorry.
Well, you said
gross.
It.
Yeah.
So you're a fanfic editor. Have you never read that before?
Oh,
have you never read?
Elisa. Oh my God, you would be terrified of the things I've read. Let me put it to you this way, okay? There are inanimate objects do not go well in NC-17 fix.
Like turkey legs.
Like turkey legs.
I read that
like
one.
Turkey leg. No, turkey legs and McGonagall do not match up. I will. Just...
The turkey leg always happens to stand out, doesn't it? We have to cut all of that out. Okay, I'm sorry for your. I'm sorry for your non-virgin eyes and ears. I'm sorry, but I figured that. Well, you said the giant squid thing. I just thought that you'd read that somewhere.
No, either. I have read plenty of giant squid and Tonks. I'm not kidding.
Do you remember that one that was giant squid and Ron?
Yes. That was terrible.
Was that?
You'd be surprised
so
how creative these people get. Like Tonks and Giant Squid. I mean, obviously we do not accept that on MuggleNet, but I mean, you would be surprised if you go and Google that. I mean, I'm not suggesting this. I mean, beware, but you will be surprised.
So don't Google
no,
it.
No, don't. But you'll be surprised. I mean, how many people write that kind of stuff?
Well, shipping anything with Giant Squid really brings a whole new meaning to sucking face.
Oh, God, Eric.
Oh, wow.
We're interested to hear all the listeners' feedback about the new scene. Personally, I think it's going to be at the Borough, but I don't know. Betting man? I don't know. Whatever. So Spiderwick Chronicles came out this week as well. Actually, last week. And we wanted to do a little movie review. Laurie, Lisa, Matt, and I all went out on a quadruple date and saw the movie. And made out during the dark scenes. And we...
Where was I?
Oh. That wasn't... Oh.
Uh-oh.
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 Who was that sitting next to me then? Whatever. So we wanted to talk about it briefly, because let me just start and say I enjoyed it. I thought it was good.
Yeah, it was a
now,
cute
Laurie,
movie.
Now, Laurie, Elise, and Matt, you all talk about how you thought it sucked. And
no,
I didn't think it sucked.
I thought
it was really cute. But there's definitely a lot of Harry Potter inspiration in the film. I don't know if the books are that way, but you could tell that this was definitely made as something to appeal to Harry Potter fans.
Well, how so, Laura? How so?
Well, you know, there's that thing that looked exactly like Buckbeak.
Yeah.
The griffin.
Yeah, but no, but it wasn't a hippogriff. It was a griffin. Totally HP unrelated.
Right.
But,
and then,
I mean, where else is that actor supposed to get work? They have to, you know, they have to make roles for it, so.
Yeah,
the
true.
Actor who played Buckbeak.
No, but actually, first of all, I want to say Freddie Highmore is such a good actor, and
yeah.
I think he's one of the most adorable people I've ever seen in my life.
Mm-hmm.
He's so cute.
I thought it was really cool. He did play twins, and as we discussed in the interview, you know, that they do a thing where the camera makes the same exact movements twice, and they digitally merge the scenes, the shots together, so there's two Freddies. It's just really cool. I mean, he did a perfect job pulling off acting like he was talking to himself. You couldn't tell.
He did.
I mean, it was like he had a twin.
Yeah, I agree.
And even the two other girls we went with, they were like, oh my God, he's not actually, you know, a set of twins. He's actually one actor.
Yeah. Right.
Remember that when we were walking out?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so what's the movie actually about?
Well, basically, it's about a family that moves into this house that belonged to, what, their great uncle or something. His name was Spiderwick, and he basically gained the sight to see all the things that humans can't see, like goblins and that type of thing. And he chronicled all of the secrets of these creatures into a book. And basically, the book was not supposed to be opened, and it was supposed to stay in the house to be protected. And Freddie Highmore and his family move into the house, and of course, he finds the book and he opens it, and there's this giant goblin that wants it so he can kill everything. And it's basically about them trying to figure out how to destroy him and how to keep the book safe.
Okay, so how much of this movie is going to remind me exactly of the last Freddie Highmore movie I saw, Arthur and the Invisibles?
I haven't seen that, so I couldn't tell you.
Neither have I.
Yeah. Because that also had a very similar, from what you guys are telling me, very similar in that, you know, the house, and it was his father, I think, or grandfather that he was trying to rescue, and he had to open and figure out how to enter the world of the Minimoys. Except this, except that movie had David Bowie, so
that's cool.
Was pretty cool.
Well, at any rate, I mean, it's been getting good reviews. I think it's fair to say that we all enjoyed it. Elisa, you want to tell a story about what you said once the credits started rolling?
Oh, the credits started rolling. I just said directed by Alfonso Cuarón because it was pretty much, I mean, the first five Harry Potter books rolled in one. And what really got me, I was so confused, I guess because I hadn't read the book. And don't get me wrong, I really did enjoy it. And I thought that, you know, Freddie Highmore did a great acting job, actually. But I was so confused by the allergy season crap that was all over the place. Like, it honestly seemed to me like it was like a promotion for Clear. I expected like a little disclaimer to show up, like symptoms may include bloody nose, saggy jowls, death by nuclear radiation. And I was just so confused. But you know what? But it was good. It was good though. I mean, I enjoyed it. I guess just, you know.
Who has asthma?
Basically, through the whole movie, it looked like a Claritin commercial. Like the sky was bright blue and there would always be like little dandelions flying around. And so it really did look like a Claritin commercial.
Wow.
It was also a promotion for Campbell's tomato soup and honey.
And honey.
Yeah.
See, I like that though. I enjoyed the little things that, like, the one little creature that lived in Spiderwick's house. He needed honey to calm him down.
Thimbletack, right? Thimbletack.
Was that Humbletack? Thumbtack.
I'm pretty sure it was Thimbletack.
Dobby?
Okay.
Was that his name?
Dobby.
It was like a Dobby creature hybrid or something.
The one thing that really got us was when they were all flying on the griffin.
Yeah.
The
two Freddie Highmores.
I just remember
when
we saw that scene, I turned over to Andrew and I said, I could have sworn I'd seen this scene before.
Yeah. It was very reminiscent. But at any rate, you know, we're just playing around having fun. It was a good movie. I would recommend you would see it. I'm sure all of us do.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's very enjoyable.
Yeah. Micah, one other thing you wanted to bring up this week is some casting news.
Yeah, we finally started to get a little bit more information about two characters, Fenrir Greyback and Amicus Caro. Both have been cast for Half-Blood Prince, so I think one of the concerns people had would probably be more on the side of Fenrir Greyback being in the movie as opposed to Amicus Caro. Don't know that many people really care if, you know, we knew the Death Eaters by name, but I was kind of getting concerned, and it still begs the question, is there more casting information to come?
Right. I'm getting really scared They're not. They have. They're not even still casting the new minister yet.
Right.
We haven't heard who's the new Scrimjowers played.
No, we have not.
I guess the one thing that could be holding them up is just that they haven't started filming with the actor yet. So, I mean, you know.
So it's not relevant to know who the actor is going to be.
Well, right now, I guess. I don't know. I'm sure, they have a reason for everything.
They got the reasons.
They're not the best reasons,
maybe he's
but
not,
they have reasons.
Maybe he's cut out. I don't think they'll cut him out of movie 7, so, you know. It just kind of happens.
Well, when would we get, is there a time that Warner Brothers releases a full cast report for a movie? Is that something that they would do?
I would think by the first teaser trailer, they would have all the casting out. I mean, that just makes sense for me because that's just when they're starting to kick off the publicity.
Yeah, it's when they're done with principal photography and everything.
Well, is that true? Teaser trailers come out before that.
Yeah. Teaser trailers can be out for anything. If you recall, even the new Indiana Jones trailer, it has some from the upcoming movie, but most of it is the previous three movies. So they can do those kinds of teasers, which just go back into those sorts of things. And I mean, if you remember the original Harry Potter trailer, which you may or may not, it was more or less, you know, Vernon Dursley going, "There's no such thing as magic," and slapping the trap, and it was like this really cool sort of, you know, teaser trailers. No, you don't need to have the whole movie completed to do that.
They kind of tease you a little bit.
They just tease you a little bit.
I guess that would make sense why they call them teaser trailers.
Yeah, that's what I was
Why do they call them trailers at all? Okay, so moving on. Announcements.
All right, so moving on to announcements. This sort of is relevant to our first news item that we were talking about. It comes from Lucas. I was planning on talking about it anyway, but Lucas read my mind as I emailed him. It's Lucas16 from Chicago. He's been on the show a couple of times when he calls in during the live shows. He writes, "I think that you guys should have one more live show that lasts for a couple hours. You haven't had one in a while, and I know that tons of people would love it." And then he talks about some other podcasts we're doing in the future. But yeah, so I think what we should do, we should do another live podcast. I'm personally itching to do another one because they are a lot of fun. Would you guys be up for doing one?
Yeah, I'd be all
soon?
For it.
Yeah, I think we should do one when they make the announcement, the director and split into two announcement, because then maybe we'll step off chapter by chapter for that live show and we'll just,
talk.
We'll talk about the official announcements and we'll have people call in and discuss, you know, what their thoughts are on the movie being split in two and the new director.
Okay.
So I think that would be a timely. I'll just say ahead of time, we're going to set some ground rules this time. First of all, no shout outs. They're fun. They're fun. We all laugh. We all LOL on the chat.
But, we can do this, you know, when
until
it actually
the point
happens.
when every person who calls in doesn't have anything to say.
Yeah, so it's just a shout out. We need to stop
that. They do that?
It slows
really?
The show down.
Yeah, and no gack.
Yeah, man.
No gack unless you're like from Nickelodeon. Okay.
Or unless you're actually like choking on something, then you can gag.
Well, or you gag. Can gag. Anyway. Yeah.
So yeah, keep an eye out. Whenever there's an official announcement, we'll try to do a live show as quickly as possible. It seems one is coming in the next 1 to 2 weeks, and that lines up with when I was sort of thinking, you know, we could do a live show anyway. So we'll just wait for that announcement. Hopefully, it's not during the week. It can be between Thursday and Saturday, but most likely it's going to be made like the announcement's going to be like a Monday morning or something terrible. So I don't know. We'll see. But we will do a live show soon for all you who are looking forward to one. So plan it out. A lot of people get upset when we announce them last minute because then they don't have time to plan ahead and tune in. So we're giving you a warning ahead of time. So that's really the only announcement that we have this week. Let's move on to Muggle Mail now.
Our first Muggle Mail comes from Naomi, 23 of Israel. She writes, "So what you all are saying is you don't have time to respond to listeners that send you nice long letters, but you have time to respond to idiots that talk trash and say horrible things to you. That's normal. Who am I kidding? I'm crazy. Wow, wow, wow."
Whoa.
But really,
no,
why?
It's whoa, 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 whoa.
Okay, that's
like
good.
Like an Indian.
Okay, that's nice. But really, why do you have the need to respond to idiots and not the people who really think before they write? Because idiots that talk like that just rant about everything. They find flaws everywhere.
That's not true.
Actually.
You're a liar.
We don't just respond to just idiot emails and stuff. We respond to stupid ones, too.
Naomi has a point. Every now and then we do like to pick out a ridiculous email to read, but those are just for fun. We don't really take them seriously.
Like, well, actually... What? Actually, hold on, wait. Actually, what we were saying last week is we replied to emails that have people complaining about the show and stuff.
Oh. Well, you know, stop your whining. That's all I have to say.
Well,
it's our show, and we'll run it the way we want to.
We mean for the people who... Wow. That's
Mama's
harsh.
Gonna crack the wing.
No, you know what I'm really bothers me? Is every now and then I'll see an email, and actually it's pretty often, and someone will be like, I think you're doing this wrong. You should do it. And I'm like, you know what? Go make your own podcast. Just do it.
Damn.
If you don't like the way we run ours,
yeah.
Make your own.
Listen, we do everything for a reason. The reason why we said that we reply to the emails that are negative, we reply to the ones that have claims that we're doing something wrong, like a serious issue. I'm not really talking about like hate mail. Like, we don't really reply to hate mail. We just reply to things that with people who are like every so often we'll get a parent who's like, I can't believe you said this word for my son, blah, 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 blah. So like, you know.
And then we laugh.
To us, that's, yeah, I mean, you know. Moderate what your kids watch. That's or listen to. That's all I have to say. But we're family friendly here.
Yeah, we are. And the other thing I wanted to point out about this was, we do read and respond to people who send in nice things because we do it on the show. We have a whole section where we sit and we respond to people's rebuttals. We have chicken soup, so it's not like we're not taking people's stuff and replying to it. I think everybody probably replies to at least 5 emails a week that are people questioning, why can't I download this? Why isn't this working? So
right. We
do take the time to do that in addition to all the other mail.
No, yeah. But we're not trying to be mean here. We're
just saying.
We run the show how we do. We can't reply to, you know, most of the emails, the majority of emails we get are theories. So we can't reply back and be like, you know, oh, I think this is good because blah, blah, blah. You know, we just can't.
Yeah, we do read it. That's the point I think we wanted people to get from last week's show is we do read everything.
Yeah, that's all.
But we don't have the time to reply
okay.
to it.
Yeah. Well, let's not dwell on this because it, you know, people, you know, we made our point clear. Okay, next email comes from Amanda, 25 of Sunshine Coast in Australia. She actually, a lot of people wrote this response into our discussion on Gryffindor Sword last week and why Luna, Ginny, and Neville tried to steal it. She writes, this is probably one of hundreds of emails you received, but Ginny found out that Harry had Gryffindor Sword passed to him when, on page 111 of DHUK edition, it states, quote, outside in the garden over the dinner tables, the three objects Scrimgeour had given them were passed from hand to hand. Everyone exclaimed over the Deluminator and the tales of Beedle the Bard and lamented the fact Scrimgeour had refused to pass on the sword. End quote. So Ginny would have heard about it then and thought it was a great way to help Harry since she couldn't go with them and to exact some revenge on Snape too. So that's a great point.
I think that's the
explanation we needed. Let's dive in straight to chapter by chapter this week because we have a lot to discuss. We're going to do 2 chapters this week. Going to kick it off with chapter 16, which is Godric's Hollow. A short but very important chapter. It's one we all speculated about before the book came out. We were all saying Harry was going to, he had to go back to Godric's Hollow. I mean, it's now or never. So, who wants to kick it off with the short summary?
I'll do the short summary. Okay, so the short summary is, for this chapter, chapter 16, Godric's Hollow, following Ron's departure, Harry and Hermione struggle for productivity as they agree to go and find Godric's Hollow, a journey which ends at the Tomb of the Potters.
Dun, dun, dun.
So, the chapter starts off with just a lot of narration. I mean, Harry and Hermione are feeling the effects of Ron being away.
Yeah.
Right? And he's thinking about Ginny, you know. It's just all this being away hurts.
Yeah, they keep looking at, they hear noises at the door, like if Ron were to come back in, Hermione pretty much just, she delays them leaving the place where they were because Ron like won't be able to find them after that sort of thing. And Harry resorts to the Marauder's map, and he begins watching people at Hogwarts. Initially, he thinks he's going to see Ron show up there again, you know, because he's sold out for the sort of 3 meals a day that he's used to. But it turns out he just ends up watching Ginny, and Ginny becomes a comfort to him, and he wishes more than anything that she knows that he still cares about her. So, and also connection to Hogwarts, they begin to speak with Phineas Nigelis. Now, did you guys like how this was done? The whole how they kind of came to an agreement with Phineas, and they began to seek answers about what was happening at Hogwarts.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool that they utilized him that way.
Well, don't you think that Snape was the one who told him to keep an eye on him?
Well, we know that now, I guess.
Yeah.
But what did they find out from this? From these meetings? What did they?
Not much.
No, I mean, they mainly just find out what's going on at Hogwarts, like that a few students are kind of rebelling against Snape. And
Harry theorizes that the DA is still alive and well.
Which was interesting, because like while I was reading this for the first time, it's just weird, like thinking about you don't know what's going on at Hogwarts for the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like you try to picture what is going on. It'd be interesting to, you know, hear this part of the book from Ginny's perspective or Luna's. Or
well, as the reader, you're right. I mean, as the reader, you feel very empty because you haven't seen the seventh Halloween feast, you know? I mean, when you were first given the first Harry Potter book, you were expecting seven Halloween feasts and seven Christmas feasts, and you're not getting it.
Right.
So they finally get off their bums, and they decide they're going to Godric's Hollow, okay? Harry says, you know what? I want to go to Godric's Hollow. And Hermione says, well, that's a good idea. I kind of want to go there too. And so they plan on it. And basically, there are a few very interesting facts about Godric's Hollow, which I put in the notes here for you guys about Godric's Hollow. This is sort of what we know. Now, it's still a bit confusing for me how Harry knew to go there at the end of Book 6. But needless to say, by this point in Book 7, he has reason to go there based on what he...
Well, I don't think he had a reason other than just he wanted to see his parents' grave, right?
Yeah. But my question was, my former question on the show had been, how did he know that his parents were buried there? But I guess that makes sense, I guess, you know.
Yeah, nothing's really happening here. I mean, this is just a big moment for Harry just because he's finally seeing his parents' grave.
Just a Lifetime movie.
What's that?
Nothing.
It is like a Lifetime
movie. I heard
that
Elisa Mott for it.
I said it was just like a Lifetime movie. I mean, three quarters of the chapter, I felt like I was watching Lifetime.
Have
with
some
a bunch
sympathy,
of other
you heartless fanfiction mod.
No. Listen. Don't get me wrong. I like cried at the end of this chapter.
Sure,
you
did.
It was really emotional.
Sure,
but I mean,
you
that's
did.
Part of why it's a freaking. That's why it's a Lifetime movie, isn't it? Isn't that sort of like the staple of watching Lifetime?
Okay, you're talking to four guys and one other girl. I don't think one other girl.
I love this chapter, you guys. Why are you guys bagging on it?
No,
Harry
I
cried.
Liked it too. I liked it too.
No, this is a fabulous
I
chapter.
Liked it too.
So they get into Godric's Hollow, and Harry and Hermione come up upon the statue of the Potters, and like I thought that was just so cool that you know there's a statue of you as a child with your parents. The town has a statue there. It's been there for 17 years. And he just stares at it for a minute, and there's really no realization. There's no, like, you know, in the book, it's just written Harry staring at it. I don't know. Don't you guys think there should have been more,
But wouldn't that freak you out?
No, that's a moment.
Okay, maybe it was a lot, and maybe, you know, it was a lot
I think
for him
I connect.
All at once.
I think I connect with the exact response that's in the book, because you got to realize that Harry's survival impacted the entire wizarding world. You know, even though Voldemort is, a terrorist who's in England, you know, they say, I mean, being the most powerful dark wizard ever, he's pretty much the threat to the entire world. Harry's defeat of him meant something to people so much larger than Harry would ever meet and will ever know. And so coming to this statue, which he had never seen before, it was just, you know, it had been there for 17 years. I think that's fitting. And it's just, he's like the last person to see this statue of him and his parents. And it's just really, like, you know, there's nothing to say or do. He's just there. It's not a lack of emotional response. It's just an abundance of it.
Plus, it's a conscious decision on his part. It may be a subconscious decision that he can't pay too close attention to things like that just because there's that threat that he may be being watched by somebody else. And obviously that ends up happening. But, you know, if he's just goes into an emotional breakdown and he's under Polyjuice potion, you know, wouldn't that seem kind of weird that, you know, some middle-aged guy is breaking down in front of a statue?
Well,
we see later. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say the same thing that you're going to say, which is just that we see a lot of emotion later when he's at his parents' grave. And then again, you know, a little less sadness. But when they see that sign that pops up later with all like, the graffiti written on it and stuff. So I think there was so much emotion already transpiring in that short period of time that it didn't really, I don't know, it didn't really surprise me that there wasn't anything more intense at that point. But I understand that point completely, but it didn't really surprise me.
Yeah, and also the way I think about it is I think that seeing a statue of he and his family, like a memorial, is really not all that different than reading about his family in textbooks like he did at school, because it was just a representation.
Well, he didn't. Hermione I hate to interrupt. Sorry, Hermione was always the one to read about Harry in the books.
Yeah, I know, but she was the one who told him about it. I mean, that's all very much a surreal experience, because it didn't become real to him. Like, he actually said that he actually detailed the idea of his parents' bodies being beneath him under the ground.
And he said he almost wanted to crawl in and sleep with them.
Yeah. And it wasn't until then that it became real, I don't think.
Well, let's jump to the graves then.
Yeah, please.
You guys are just all about proving me wrong with future events. Go ahead, Micah.
Mention one thing. I thought it was interesting that it first appeared as a war memorial, and then
what was up
with turned
that?
Into the Potters.
Yeah, well, what kind of war memorial?
Well, it could be that. Like, well, think about the Godric's Hollow. Think about Godric's Hollow. Godric's Hollow is not an all magical town like Hogsmeade. Hogsmeade's the only all magical establishment in Britain, but Godric's Hollow is kind of a half magical, half Muggle thing. Now, think about Harry and Hermione, who are under the Polyjuice Potion as Muggles. I think that the War Memorial, I mean, considering Lily and James are only significant to Muggles, I mean, to magic people, you know, I mean, they're significant to Muggles, but Muggles would never understand why. You couldn't even begin to explain. So I think if they're going to, you know, if the wizards are going to build a memorial to, I mean, quite like the Potter's House, which you see in the next chapter, it's just, I think the whole deal with it was that the War Memorial was, you know, once they got closer to it, it kind of revealed itself, just like the cottage did, because they weren't Muggles. You know,
my point was that it's more symbolic.
Oh, it's a battle scar.
You know, the Potters, what?
Well, it's like a,
the Potters are the central point of this war against Voldemort. And the fact that a war memorial changed over to, you know, a statue of Lily, James, and Harry, I thought was, you know, symbolic in a sense of what is taking place in this book.
Mm-hmm.
That was more of where I was
going. War memorial, though, isn't that what the Muggles see? Isn't that sort of the disguise for Lily and James and Harry?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I
was just curious as to like, which war that was for. I mean, obviously it has to be something valid if it's going to fool the Muggles.
WW2.
Or the Australian-American War.
Okay, so the graves. They go through the graveyard. They're finding different people. And Harry's getting frustrated because Hermione keeps pointing out, you know, different graves other than his parents. But then finally, of course, it's Hermione who finds the grave. Well, okay, first we'll talk about the inscription on Kendra.
Ariana.
And Ariana Dumbledore's grave. I guess, Eric, you had this in here, so you should probably talk about it.
Yeah, there's two inscriptions they come across in this graveyard. One of them is on the grave of Dumbledore's mother and sister, and the other one's on James and Lily's tomb. And Harry makes note of the second one and has some open dialogue about Hermione, but the first one on Kendra and Ariana's grave is reads as such: where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. What do you guys think that means?
Well, first of all, that's from the Bible. It's from Matthew 6:21. It is
now,
actually.
Wait a second. How do you know that? Did you Google it
afterwards?
No,
I looked it up. And basically, both of these phrases are from the Bible.
Isn't that nice that Joe did a little tribute to Laura Mallory? Deathly Hallows.
Here lies Laura Mallory. Thanks.
That's a little
no,
too
no,
much.
No.
But actually,
in the dust there, in the dust, or rather, the marble of the graves.
There, it's really interesting if you read Matthew 6, and you're looking at lines 19 through 21, that section is called Lay Up Treasures in Heaven. And it says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And I thought it was really fitting, like, to say that you should really treasure the important things in your life, and not link your entire being to material possessions that will have no meaning when you're gone.
That's kind of a...
isn't that a little ironic? Given, I mean, isn't Dumbledore the one who put that inscription on there?
Yeah, well, that's the open dialogue, yeah. Is that when they talk about this, Harry says it makes sense that Dumbledore would be the one to choose this because he was the oldest member of his family after Kendra and Ariana.
Well, it's possibly something that his mother said. I mean, he had to have, you know, gotten his loving nature from someone from his family. Maybe his mother was the one who was very loving and concerning, and probably that's where Dumbledore got most of his sayings
like
from.
Mm-hmm.
Elisa, did you have something else to say about that? Or?
No. I just wanted. I wasn't quite sure what it meant. I at first, my thought was that maybe. I don't know what I was thinking, but I thought there's maybe some kind of significance to it, and like a Horcrux or something. But obviously,
yeah, I was kind of thinking the same thing. Like where your treasure is, there your heart will be. Like
exactly.
Like your treasure, right. You put your soul into.
Your soul in your treasure.
Right.
It's kind of an. Exactly. I think we're meant to think of that a little bit, because like obviously,
yeah,
it's, the
it's
quote
just
from
a
Bible,
little bit.
Maybe.
It's to be contrasted with the kind of life mm-hmm. that Voldemort is living, that he has souls and
right.
Horcruxes, for the fact that treasure and heart can mean nothing about means of survival in the mortal world, but be actually really meaningful. You know, on.
I think that makes perfect sense. The Horcrux parallel.
Yeah,
it makes good sense. I mean, you know. Obviously, Matthew wasn't jotting this down, thinking about Horcruxes
no.
and J.K. Rowling.
Well,
2,000
honestly,
years
though,
later.
I don't think that. I mean, we know that Jo is a Christian. I don't think that she would use a biblical quote in reference to something evil like a Horcrux.
Well, no, but it's the kind of thing about being well written. You know, is that you can imply all these things from it. You can take all these things out of it. She's also, I mean,
oh, yeah,
all the
I know.
Time when she wrote that. In this chapter, just five times, it's appeared how the little beating heart inside the locket is going faster and faster
yeah.
and faster.
I think maybe it might have been less of a reference to a Horcrux directly and more of a reference of, you know, like anti-Horcrux, perhaps.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Mean,
it's
think...
to be contrasted.
Yeah.
It's to be absolutely
exactly.
contrasted. It has nothing to do with a Horcrux, but you're meant to think. Or you know, it's in there. It's definitely there to think.
Yeah.
About. But so on James and Lily's tomb, what about the second inscription? And Harry questions that isn't this what the Death Eaters think? It's it says the last enemy that will be defeated is death.
Yeah,
Harry sort
I like
of
that
ruined
one.
The moment. Yeah, Harry sort of ruined the moment for me right there though, because it seemed like he was getting angry. Wasn't he?
He was. Well, he read it wrong because Hermione was like, "It's not a bad thing."
Yeah. This is a very angry chapter, though. This is
yeah.
If you're you know sort of following Harry throughout. Everything that's been going on in this book in particular, you know, and you're not a fan of Dumbledore. I know there are a couple of people like Jess out there who
the name
don't
one
like Dumbledore.
Who should be spammed.
But you get very aggravated, at least I did, rereading the chapter with Dumbledore. Because here you have, I think, just two rows behind, you know, the Potter's Graves behind Ariana and Kendra, Dumbledore's, and you start thinking to yourself, why was Harry never brought to Godric's Hollow? Why was Harry never given this information? And it really starts to sink in, because up until this point, you know, it's sort of been like, okay, Dumbledore didn't pass along this information. You can deal with it. But once you start to see the reality that Harry's going through, that he's sitting in his parents' grave, and Dumbledore had this information all along and never shared anything with him. I mean, I would
be frustrated.
You're right, this
too.
Is the moment where it hits Micah. And I mean, you did the news item where J.K. Rowling had said that there is legitimate concern in that Dumbledore was, well, I guess using Harry as a puppet was the term used. But I mean, this is the moment where, I mean, Harry's thinking about walking with Dumbledore. What an emotional impact he thinks that would be for them both to have walked there. He said, I think the term is, what a strong bond that would be for Dumbledore to have taken him to this place. And he didn't. And the line is something to the effect of, you know, oh, was it more important to just get Harry to do what he wanted him to do? And I mean, you're right. This is the chapter where it starts really hitting home.
Well, not even Dumbledore. Nobody ever took him.
Well, nobody took him. Yeah, that's kind of sad.
Well, do you think that Dumbledore really thought about before he died about this precaution, about how dangerous it would be if he went back to Godric's Hollow?
It's a good question.
I think he would have been able to deal with the situation without ever drawing attention to those graves. yes, they're close together, but I still think that, you know, Dumbledore may have been able to go to Godric's Hollow and sort of not pay any attention to the two graves that were there. And maybe in the end, that's the reason why he never took Harry there. Maybe that would be the explanation, that it would just be too difficult for him to deal with everything surrounding his mother and his sister.
Yeah. Now, Andrew, I actually want to hear what you think this little inscription means. I thought your interpretation was interesting.
Okay, well, what I think... Okay, Hermione's probably right. I'll just say that first. However, when I look at it and I think about it, I feel like it means that... This may sound stupid, but this is just an alternate interpretation. That once everyone in the world is dead, then there will no longer be death, and it is therefore defeated. Let me read the line back. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. Will be defeated. It won't exist anymore because everyone's dead already and they can't die anymore.
Okay, but that's like... Okay, that would be like saying that everything on the planet would have to die, though. Like, including the planet itself.
Honestly, I never thought of it like that, and I don't think it's a stupid theory at all. I just think that...
Thanks.
I really don't. I think, though, that, that it sort of assumes that maybe in order to destroy death, you have to eradicate it, and I think that with something as ambivalent as, excuse me, as death, that it's something that more has to be overcome and not eradicated. And I sort of think that that's where maybe Laura's interpretation fits in, is that if you can overcome it, then that is sort of destroying death in a sense. And I think that James and Lily were overcoming it through, you know, keeping Harry alive through their sacrifice, as she had suggested.
Well, Laura, what is your interpretation?
Well, it's basically what Elisa just said, that it's for anybody who has overcome their fear of death. And, I mean, I think about Lily and James, who are living on in their son.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
I think that regardless of what your belief in any sort of afterlife is, you do leave an impression in this world, whether it's through your children or through the things that you've done. I really think that you do. And just like reading it in terms of how it's presented in the Bible, because it's in Corinthians, that whole, it's like Corinthians 15, 26 or something, but all through Corinthians 15, it's about the resurrection of Christ. And it talks about that. And there was one part that was kind of eerie reading it, because it reminded me a lot of the scene where Harry was walking to the Forbidden Forest and he saw his mother and father and Remus all standing around him when he put on the resurrection stone. Because it, like, talked about how there would be one to be resurrected and all the apostles would see him and all this other stuff. And it was really...
Wow.
You could definitely tell that J.K. Rowling was schooled very much in religion.
That's a good call, Laura.
Yeah. Well, that's what I thought of when I was rereading it, was I thought specifically of the Deathly Hallows and, you know, Harry being the master of death, and the fact that, you know, he has that whole scene at King's Cross. And, you know, I like what Elisa was saying just before about, you know, the Potters living on through Harry. You know, they, in their own way, they defeated death by... You know, stepping in front of the curses that were meant for Harry, I guess Lily more so than James, but even still, you know, James died protecting his family, and you know, Harry sort of gives up at the end and knows that him sacrificing himself is supposedly for the greater good, and you know, that kind of quote to me ties in with the Hollows and ties in with his actions in, you know, the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
before we go to chapter 17, can we just like talk about the scene as a whole, as like when they film it in the movie, like how beautiful it's going to be when you see Harry and Hermione holding each other, looking at the parents' grave in the snow?
Yeah, you know, and I was thinking of that, and immediately I closed my eyes and I could just picture the typical Emma Watson.
But see,
Rory,
that's the
face.
Thing I'm kind of upset. I mean, kind of nervous for, like. I think it'd be a little better in the film if they don't actually go through the Polyjuice potion. So you actually see Harry and Hermione holding each other in the gravesite rather than what they look like through the Polyjuice potion.
What's it going to mean, these two strange actors?
Yeah, exactly. It's supposed to be a touching
moment.
It's
sentimental, but yeah, you're right. I don't think... And the Polyjuice potion, Like, that's one of the that's kind of what they're saying about movie 6. You know, there's all these precautions they take to make, you know, to make clear how unsafe the world is, but I think it's a better story to tell in a movie if they are not under the Polyjuice potion at this exact moment. We questioned whether they would be in the ministry scene.
This is a very different I was going to say something. I lost my train of thought. It's just the perspective you have while reading, you see Harry and Hermione, but in a movie, it's not nearly as effective. They're going to have to really do something about that. Because, you're right. Like Matt and Eric, you were both saying, seeing two random people holding each other just won't make sense.
Reading this chapter, I mean, you kind of get an idea as to why Ron wasn't written into it. Because I just can't see him being in this.
Yeah, I agree. I can't. Yeah,
that's a good point. That's a really good point.
I was wondering. I'm not sure that if this was specified or if I'm remembering it incorrectly. But who decided on that epithet? The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. Do we know?
I don't think it was ever specified who chose it.
It's probably maybe a favorite from Lily or James of the Deathly Hallows from Beetle and the Bard.
Well, I would rather venture and say that Dumbledore did that one too. I would like to think that.
Well, here's what I was going to say, and I have no evidence of this whatsoever, but I was almost positive that I read somewhere, maybe in one of the interviews that J.K. Rowling did after the release, that Dumbledore had written that, and if so, that gives a whole new perspective to it, because if Dumbledore wrote that, it would sort of almost be like, I suppose, a redemption in a way, that he was sort of, because he went through that whole phase of trying to obtain, you know, the Deathly Hallows and defeating death in a way that it can't be defeated, at least not, you know, but he wrote that sort of saying, I've realized my mistake and, you know, where I made an error in judgment, and I know, I've learned through Lily and James that the only way to destroy death is to face it and not to run from it.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Very nicely put.
Thanks.
Wow.
Elisa, you're the girl. You're hired.
Yeah.
You know, Laura, get off the show. You
oh,
suck.
No. Screw you!
No, screw you! Laura!
I'm just kidding.
You can keep the P.O. box.
Laura! Bye!
Oh, yes.
Speaking of the P.O. box, Andrew, my mom told me that some girl sent you this very serious love letter.
She reads the letter?
Like, what is she doing opening my personal love letters?
No, she didn't, like, put a name on the envelope.
I'm just playing.
She wanted to be found by someone else.
Well, I look forward to seeing it and being creeped out. let's go to chapter 17. I'm just kidding, whoever
Call
sent that
Crime
in.
Stoppers.
I'm sure it's nice. We should move on to chapter 17 now. Bathilda's secret. Basically, in this chapter, to sum up Eric's short summary, hiss, hiss, bite, hiss, crunch, I can fly, hey, cute picture, wait, that's him.
No, you totally destroyed that, Andrew. I write these summaries, I put all my heart into them, and it would be...
Half of it was hiss.
No.
I think it came
increasing
off.
Increasing degrees. Yeah. Okay.
I think it came off funny.
Can I read the short summary? Bite. Hiss. Crunch. My wand. Look at my wand. I can fly. I can fly. I can fly. Hey, cute picture. Wait. That's him. No.
Wow.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, my God. That's the short summary.
Elisa Montfort, the only one clapping for her.
That's because she's really polite.
Thank you, Skype meters. And she's new. She has to suck up everyone.
Yeah, she'll be meaner next time.
All right.
Yeah. All right, so this chapter, I don't know what to think about this chapter. I mean, this is another... They should have seen this coming. Like, come on. She was so... While everyone was reading this for the first time, did you know that something was up with Bathilda?
Oh,
like,
of course.
Absolutely.
Of course. Oh, obviously. It was obvious she was a snake.
It was absolutely obvious that a giant snake was possessing Bathilda's dead corpse and inhabiting the carcass and leading Harry alone so that she could bite him and break his... Yes.
Thank you, Eric.
So
God,
gross.
It was so obvious.
Matt, you and I are the only ones worthwhile or worthy of reading these kinds of books.
The only reason I could see someone thinking that, okay, there wasn't anything up with her just because they had heard at the wedding that she was just gaga. So, I don't know. Obviously, something was up to us because, you know, something's bound to happen. It was, you know, every 30 pages, there's like a new big scary Voldemort.
Yeah,
attack.
It was about. The whole mood is supposed to change anyway, so we were expecting a big change in the mood.
Yeah. So, but first off, in the beginning of this chapter, Harry feels excited because he gets a little boost, a little inspiration boost, because he sees this graffiti on this plaque honoring him.
I think that was just what he needed.
Yeah.
Because he's getting very skeptical of Hermione and Ron, and he was right that, I mean, they were kind of doubting him a little bit, and so now he's been thinking this whole entire time that his best friends are doubting his ability, and are they really, I mean, they may be with him, but are they really, in a sense? And yeah, so he reads these graffitis on the scene, on the sign saying what does it say on the sign?
Oh, it says, "Good luck, Harry, wherever you are. If you read this, Harry, we're all behind you. Long live Harry Potter."
Well, yeah, the house is still there. Most of the house is still there, in fact.
Yeah, that's really cool, too, how there's like a little tribute. I mean, they kept the house there as
a
tribute.
A
like, that's just amazing. I really cannot wait to see that in a movie. Because Harry even, well, the narration even points out that, you know, there is the blasted corner of the house, which is obviously where Voldemort killed his mother and tried to kill Harry.
And remember, we've seen this house, guys, in the movie, and when Hagrid, in the first movie, when Hagrid's doing the recount, we see Voldemort going to that. I thought that would be really cool if they reshoot those scenes sort of with the actors, try and recreate it, but then actually, you know, elaborate with all of the things that happened, at the end of this chapter, which is just fantastic.
Well, see, that's what I had a question about, too, because they said in the beginning when they did this movie of the first film that J.K. Rowling oversaw this entire scene.
I think she directed that scene or something.
Do you honestly, I think she did direct it too. Do you think that they may have actually filmed the entire scene and are saving it for the last film?
No, I highly
doubt
that. If you think about it, the James and Lily actors are very happy to return. They've been in almost all the movies. In fact, they've been in all the movies. They really have.
But the baby, it doesn't look like that. He's probably a couple years older now.
Well, heaven forbid,
like 10 years older now.
Find another child. Well, you're right.
That's kind of a good theory, Matt. I mean, because I really don't think they would have to film much extra. Like, I don't know. It's hard to say because if you think about the movie scene in Sorcerer's Stone, it's not exactly how it is in the book.
No, it's not. But also, the actors are 10 years older almost, too, from when they filmed that first, from when they filmed that scene.
Although Harry was standing in the crib and he had a little smile on his face in the movie, didn't he?
A little bit.
Yeah, he did.
It's very similar.
He was wearing Blue's Clues pajamas too.
He was.
And she was,
yeah.
and they stressed it enough that she was very adamant about getting this scene right. She probably had this whole scene, you know, she had it all envisioned in her head. I still think they may have filmed the entire
scene. The idea of that. It's just in the history of movies where it seems like in my history of movies, my experience, when I think that it would be really cool if they did that, they never do that, which is the only thing I have against it.
I mean, at the very least, they must have some extra footage laying around. They must have done some extra takes, maybe some extra angles or two. Maybe they could make a whole thing out of it.
You don't even see James's character in that flashback.
Right, you don't. That's one issue,
So, are we going to talk about Bathilda picking them up then?
Yeah. That's a great point, Matt. But I guess we'll have to wait and see. That's a good question for Haman or somebody. Okay, so Harry finds the photograph of Dumbledore and Grindelwald in Bathilda's house. And, sorry, I'm reading from whoever wrote this. He's also convinced by looking in her eyes that she knows who he is. He's partly right.
Yeah, I was kind of... I don't know. Just reading that, it kind of creeped me out because Hermione said something along the lines of, like, do you think she knows who we are or whatever? And Harry looks into Bathilda's eyes and he's like, yeah, I think she does. And it's creepy because he's right, but not quite, you know, because it's actually Voldemort's snake. And it's, oh my gosh.
There's a really cool, like, shivers. I like how this is written because, and again, with the Horcrux that Harry's wearing, gets excited, you know, it starts really sort of beating and Harry really starts noticing it.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, you know, I guess it's starting to be scared. That's good. It's scared that it's about to be destroyed. But you know that that's not actually quite what's happening. And it's just really... just really an intense sort of scary scene.
Yeah, it really is.
That whole scene is going to be so freaking awesome in the
movie. If they do it right. Like, do you think they're actually going to have the snake, like, crawl out of Bathilda's neck?
Oh, they better.
I would be so mad.
If they didn't.
It was like, yeah, it just like transfigures into a snake or something.
Oh, that would be so terrible.
Yeah, or if they do something cheap like they've done in every movie where they show a shadow. But then, like in Chamber of Secrets, in order to lessen the gore factor, they had Fox pecking out the basilisk eyes, but they only showed a shadow.
But they don't cop that
right
out.
But keep in mind that was the PG days.
We're almost rated R, ladies and gentlemen.
Practically, yeah, we're all big boys. The other thing, Laura, that I remember is I just totally lost my
What about when Peter Pettigrew cut off his hand?
Did they show the shadow of that?
They showed it about like it just tipped off the arm.
Well, and it made the squishy sound.
Yeah, it was pretty.
What I'm thinking of is, remember in Prisoner of Azkaban when Peter Pettigrew escapes the binds by turning into the rat, and he does that thing where he disappears sort of into his clothing, and you know the rat comes out there. Like that's exactly the effect I'm looking for in this Bathilda transformation scene.
She doesn't really transform. The snake is hiding inside the body.
Well, no, she doesn't. She doesn't.
No,
but,
it comes
well, like,
out of her body.
Like I wrote in my notes, she pretty much discards the carcass like a coat. Like discards the body like a coat, and it lets it drop to the floor as the snake like sort of slithers out of it, like
a snake would shed its skin.
Exactly.
Well, I kind of thought about that. I kind of got a I thought about that when I was thinking of what's the movie? Men in Black, when the creature took out the insides of the body, and all it really was just like a layer of skin that just stretched over the body.
He was wearing like an Egger suit.
like an Egger suit. Yeah.
Come to think of it, though, this would really be a scary scene for kids.
I know.
I mean, even if it is rated PG-13, huh? I don't know, but let's stick with the book here. Let's wrap this up. So as we were just discussing, I guess we could skip this too. Harry sees his parents' death through Voldemort's point of view, which is really cool.
Well, we can't skip this. We can't skip this.
Well, no,
this.
I'm
this
saying we already
incredible.
Discussed a good part of it.
Yeah.
Movie-wise, but...
I'm shocked at how little I remembered how cool this actual part was when I was reading it the first time. Book 7, that is. Because it really is truly cool.
Yeah, correct me.
What did you guys
think? Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this the first time that we find out that James Potter didn't even have his wand when Voldemort came?
Neither of them did.
He just falls.
Didn't we discuss this on an earlier show?
Yeah, this has been it's been said in the books that sort of James was dueling Voldemort or whatever, you know, went into the landings to sort of duel him, but Now we see it's a little bit even more pathetic than that for you know James and Lily Potter who've thrice defied Voldemort to just drop, you know, and of course Lily didn't have to die, but James just didn't even have his wand.
Mm-hmm. Well, just about the whole thing with Harry's mom and how he kind of pushed her away. Like we all thought that there was like some ulterior motive that he promised that he wouldn't kill.
Didn't he? Isn't that confirmed later? Yeah, Snape asked him.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Never mind.
But I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm just going to say my absolute favorite thing about this Voldemort recap is that right when he's about to kill Harry, he thinks the baby Harry might, or Harry or Voldemort thinks that the baby Harry might be thinking that Voldemort is actually his dad in disguise, that any moment Lily's going to pop up and smile and it's all a joke. But as Voldemort gets closer to Harry to kill him, he sees that it's not Voldemort and begins crying. And at that moment, Voldemort thinks, I have it written down here, Voldemort thinks, well, he says he did not like
the
crying. He had never been able to stomach the small ones crying in the orphanage. And this is like... right when he's about to die, right when Voldemort's about to kill Harry and be killed himself, he has this flash to he connects the crying to the orphanage and these crying babies in the orphanage. This is Voldemort's human life, and not only that, but his childhood. He makes this connection to his childhood, and of all these, you know, these crying that he couldn't stand in the orphanage. It sort of connects him to the human world once again, to even acknowledge that he'd ever been in an orphanage, a muggle wanted that, and then it struck me so much. You can clearly tell by the way my voice doing this that it struck me that kind of connection to, you know, Voldemort's, because Voldemort's not connected to anything, but right before he dies, he makes that kind of, you know, I hated the little ones, the orphanage.
Well, when
that's totally true.
And yeah,
then he dies.
Well, when I read that, when he said that he couldn't stomach the babies crying at the orphanage, I could be wrong, but I thought when he said that, he meant that he went on a murderous rampage in the orphanage, and it was just hard.
Well, he was about to kill a trick-or-treater. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Mm. He said, like, one quick wave of his wand, and the little boy would never see his mother again or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but quite well, he just loved the power of that, I think. He was thinking to himself, like, I could just kill this kid right now, and that entire life is gone.
Now, Laura, you had a parallel you wanted to bring up?
Oh, yeah. Well, we all know how I am about the parallels. And
yeah.
This is a really small one. It's not anything major that requires tons of discussion, but it was just interesting to me, like, especially thinking about the scene that we talked about in Sorcerer's Stone that Joe monitored so heavily, specifically shows Voldemort entering the gate of the Potter's house, and in the book, Harry says that he can see the bald man entering the gate of Bathilda's home, and it's like the first time that they've both been in Grimmauld Place and all this time, and both times it happened in Book 7 and Book 1. So I just thought it was really interesting. Another one of my little book parallels.
And why do we love parallels?
Because they never meet.
I was just disappointed because there had been so much speculation that there had been somebody else at
Godric's
Hollow that night.
Yeah.
And then to not have anything, really. I mean,
yeah,
I think everyone pretty much assumed that Snape was the one who sort of made sure that Lily would at least be offered some sort of protection. But it seemed like, even going back to the movie you guys were talking about, people were always saying, oh, it seems like if you look the right way, there was somebody else there in the shadows. But in the end, it ended up not being anybody at all.
Yeah, and I mean, when we were...
Voldemort by himself.
When we were in London doing our live show, I went out on a limb and made a big speculation about who I thought it was going to be. And then it ended up being no one. I said, well, I wasn't 100% convinced of this, but I figured if it was going to be someone there, it was going to be someone we wouldn't expect. So I was like, Dumbledore. Maybe Dumbledore was there, and that's why he has all this stuff and da-da-da-da. But, of course, it makes no sense now, but...
Yeah. Yeah, Dumbledore was a big theory that I remember that being passed around a lot. I think you did present an interesting theory at that show.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what I said.
Yeah, I just remember it being really good.
But then no one in the audience, I remember, you said something like, everybody raise your hand if you think that's right, and like two people raised their hands.
Well,
see,
you have to remember,
screw you.
There were three levels of people. We couldn't see, you know, the upper and lower,
that's true.
I'm sure. We should have been like, stop your feet if you think
that. Yeah, they would put another light out in the bookstore.
Oh, that was a classic.
Yeah,
moment.
That was so
funny. Elise and Matt and Micah, you weren't there, you losers. Okay,
oh my
so.
God. Thanks,
kidding.
Andrew.
Yeah. I'm just kidding.
Jerk.
Okay, so I think that's about it.
Well, just one more thing.
Okay.
When Harry is, when
you're
Harry
like,
is...
You're like Steve Jobs at his Apple keynotes. He always goes, but there is one more thing. And then the whole crowd goes,
P.S. the MacBook Air. Yeah. Okay, so, no, just when Harry is recapping afterwards, I mean, he'd been tossing and turning in his sleep for hours, which is, you know, as it turns out. But when he recounts that Bathilda was actually, Bathilda Bagged Snake, I should say, Bathilda Bagsnake was speaking Parseltongue, and that's why Harry sort of could understand her and knew that she was saying, come, look at this, that sort of thing. But I don't think it's actually right that Hermione were to let Harry go upstairs alone if she couldn't also hear Bathilda saying those sort of things, like, come here, and I want you, you know, and all this other stuff. You know, not only did Hermione let Harry go up alone with Bathilda, but she didn't even follow until she started hearing these loud thumps. I mean, if Nagini were any kind of, you know, aim or anything, I mean, if the intent were to be to kill Harry, Nagini would have succeeded because Hermione stayed completely downstairs. I just don't think it was realistically suspicious. She wasn't realistically suspicious enough because if she couldn't hear Bathilda even speak, or, you know, if she would have heard the slithering, I would have been severely, you know, clued in.
It's possible they communicated, though, through nonverbal means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there is that connection that still exists between Voldemort
and
Harry.
Yeah.
Perhaps they don't need any sort of verbal communication.
But that would be weird, wouldn't it? I mean, you'd immediately know that something was up if Hermione... Because if Hermione, like... Hermione didn't hear a thing. She didn't hear a thing. And maybe she heard some sizzling and didn't realize it.
Well, this whole idea is pretty stupid from the beginning, okay? This kind of goes back to my thoughts on, like, them infiltrating the ministry. This was just another scene where, like, you know what? You're really...
out of your league.
Effing stupid. You know, I mean, you're just going to follow somebody that you'd never met before.
You don't talk to strangers.
Going to their house.
But see, at the same time, they were pretty confident that she had the sword. You know, like earlier in the chapter or the chapter prior, Harry was like, you know, Harry and Hermione were both like, okay, she must have it. It makes sense. Dumbledore must have given it to her. So
yeah,
I think they just got too caught up in the
moment.
Well,
really, it's mostly Harry. I mean, Hermione was hesitant first, and usually, like every time Hermione's first reaction is hesitation, it's usually because you should be hesitant about it.
Well, I think over time, though, their lack of knowledge, their lack of things happening, and Ron leaving them kind of makes them put all their eggs in one basket. And I think that's why Harry, when he says, "I want to go to Godric's Hollow," Hermione says, "Yeah, that's a pretty good idea." Mm-hmm. She kind of says,
"It was just."
But you're right, Mike. You're completely right.
It's just not a wise decision, and the fact that you brought up, I mean, Harry can clearly hear what she's saying, but it's not like they're having open dialogue. It's not like they're having back and forth conversation. You know, it's just a little bit awkward.
Well, I mean, I think what worked in the favor was that they knew how old Bathilda was, you know, so they thought that when she was kind of gliding on the ice that she might be, you know, but she's a very weak, obviously very old woman who might have the Sword of Gryffindor, but... Just putting Harry and Hermione's failings aside, when Voldemort flies there and ends up in that room, it is said in the book that he looks out the window and sees Harry and Hermione as their disguised people running across the field, and that's where he breaks down and says, "No!" And obviously he looks down and he gets this nice little consolation prize, which is the photo of Grindelwald, so he can figure out who it is he wants to go after. But he sees them running across the field. Why does he not follow them? That is my question. That's my last question. Why doesn't he follow them if he sees them running?
Because they
apparate. Fly. He can overtake them. Who says they apparate? Hermione's trying to carry Harry. She can't even do that.
Well, didn't
that.
They? She did has... she say they twisted and they were
apparate.
Gone?
They
saw a twist
apparate.
And they were gone, and then he starts screaming. Yeah.
Oh, I missed that. Sorry.
Yeah, I think she apparated as they like fell out or something.
I thought they twisted their heel out. Or something.
They clicked their heels three times.
Hermione twisted in midair, and the thundering of the collapsing house rang in Harry's ears as she dragged him once more into darkness. Yeah, they apparated.
Into darkness. Okay, that's what I get.
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought that was like the darkness of behind a tree or something. I was like, why is he not going after them? Okay, but I get that. Okay.
And the only other thing I would bring up from this chapter is the fact of the broken wand, because that plays a huge role. Later
I like
on.
It though.
Should we play a song
series.
For Harry's wand?
We should play a song.
Even though it comes back.
We should play a song for Bathilda, actually, because it's confirmed now that she's completely dead.
Mm-hmm. What do you guys want to hear?
My milkshake brings other boys to the yard.
That's a little out of place. I guess we'll jump right into the next segment, but first it's time for Quote Quiz! Quiz. This is Lane for Chapter 17. This week, and
18.
Chapter 18: The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore. And the quote is: "This is a hard one for all you playing at home. Here are a head case, that Aberforth." It's a quote quiz for you this week.
Did they mumble too, or was that just you?
I didn't mumble.
Oh, okay.
No, that's what Joe wrote. So we're doing a new segment. We tested this last week for Laura, Eric, and Elisa. It's make the music connection, and we make a connection between. We're gonna start this week making a connection between a song I give you and Harry Potter.
Ooh,
okay, so it's sort of like make the connection, only involves music, and the intro goes like this: "It's make the music connection."
Very nice.
Good job.
So Eric,
Andrew.
Since you're a lost dork and you have to get out of here.
So you're going to give us the song and we're going to have to place it in the series as opposed to us coming up
with
the song.
Exactly. I'm going to give you
that's a lot easier.
Okay. Good.
I hope.
All right. So Eric, this is your first song.
Yesterday
Yesterday by The Beatles. Make a connection between this song and Harry Potter.
That's a really good question. I mean, oh, sorry, this is a really good connection to be made. I think that an instance where this song would be most pertinent... Actually, what about write this... I think a lot of characters are singing this song at different points in the book. Particularly, well, clearly Harry. Plenty of people the night that Voldemort is... You know what? Dumbledore sings this when he goes back to his office after the Triwizard Tournament has ended and Voldemort's back. You know, yesterday all my troubles seemed so far away.
Okay.
Darn it, he's back again.
All right, that's good.
Yeah, or Ron sings it.
Wait, so what scene was it?
Then I'll do the other one. Ron singing it after he left Hermione. You know, because we read in these chapters that Hermione's crying and stuff. All over Ron. Well, that's what Ron is at home or in the bushes by his house singing this song, like, why did I have to go and be so dumb and leave? And sorry, yesterday sucked, but I should have left, you know.
Okay.
Anyway, gotta go.
All right.
Okay. Bye, Eric.
Eric, we'll see you later.
Okay. Bye, everybody. Thanks for the great
show.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Micah, it is your turn for Make the Music Connection. You ready?
Yeah. Let's go.
All right, this is your song.
Let's do it.
Of course, the Billy Joel.
Only the Good Die Young by Billy Joel. Make a connection, sir.
I would probably say when Harry is going through, Hogwarts, and he's looking over the table and he sees Remus and Tonks. Because in reality, they're still pretty young, you know.
Okay.
But it's kind of a more upbeat song, you know. It has like some really solemn lyrics, but it's an upbeat song, so I don't. It's kind of hard to place that.
The lyrics are terrible if you listen to it. If you get the meaning of the song, it's terrible. I don't know what it is. I've just heard it's terrible.
I can just see Harry running down the Great Hall seeing Remus and Tonks lying there dead, and then he just breaks out and dances to the song.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Matt, you're next.
Okay.
Actually, no. Let's get a girl.
Oh.
Matt, you're next.
I knew it! Mike, I knew you were going to say something.
Matt's actually heard, too, I think.
He knew that. It's like Andrew set that up perfectly.
I was waiting for someone to say something.
I didn't even think about that, despite the fact that Matt does have girl attributes. But anyway, Elisa, here's your song. Misty Mountain Hop by Zeppelin. I hear you're a fan.
Oh, are you kidding me? Of course. Oh, gosh. Well, they're all British. How's that for a connection?
Okay.
Misty Mountain Hop. Let me think. I'm going to say that this is Tonks and the Giant Squid's love music. That's the connection.
Okay. All right. Very good.
Oh, God.
Okay. Laura, you're next. Okay. Keep in mind, I'm tailoring all these songs to everyone's interests this week. So.
Yeah, I'm just guessing what mine's going to be.
Laura may know what's coming.
Oh, boy.
Oh.
This song makes me cry.
Another turning point, a fork stuck in the road. Time grabs you by the wrist, directs you where to go. So make the best
time of your life by Green Day.
Well, I think there are multiple meanings you can pull out of this song. One of the first things I think of is when Billy Joe says time grabs you by the wrist and directs you where to go. Because Harry didn't really have much of a choice with his destiny. It was kind of thrust upon him. And also, if you know anything about Green Day and this song, you know it's actually not a happy song. So, and it's not even supposed to be a nice song. It's actually all kind of sad. So the whole, it makes me think of Harry Potter ending. It makes me sad.
Aww.
So, sadness and Harry's destiny.
Okay, good. I like it. All right, and last but not least, Matthew Britton, here's your song.
I knew it! A Disney song.
Oh. You didn't know it. I love when he gets constipated for a second. Circle of Life. It was written by Elton John, right?
Yeah.
I think make a connection.
God. Damn. It's like, well, there were animals in it, and our Patronuses are animals, and I got nothing here.
Now I'm picturing all the Patronuses coming up on the big mountain with Simba.
Well, Simba and Harry were both orphans.
Yeah.
Who had to?
Oh, that's
yeah, but are we making a music connection to an exact scene in a film
or books?
It could be in the film, or you know,
or
you
in the
a
book.
Scene
I
for
mean,
Deathly
I'm
Hallows.
Sorry, a scene in the books.
It could be books or movies, whatever.
Well, that's what I mean. Okay. Jeez, I have no idea. I'm sorry.
Hey Matt, what about Harry or Simba's parental figure dies to save Simba?
Oh, I got it. And I can connect the movies, but not the song. Sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
I was thinking because at the very end when Simba and Scar starts walking in circles, it's just like what Harry and Voldemort did at their final showdown.
Well, that's true.
But the song is just so happy in life, and I can't really make a circle of life because no one gets killed and then eaten after they get turned into grass or something.
How about that?
Yeah, or just the opening of the entire series, the prologue. There we go.
The circle of life is that Harry ends up marrying a woman that looks exactly like his mother.
Oh. What kind of fan fiction do you do now, Lisa?
No, yeah. I'm just saying. I mean, seriously, a lot of people were making talking about parallels that, you know, Harry looks exactly like James and that Ginny looks exactly like Lily. I mean, I'm not like suggesting anything. I'm just saying, circle of life. There you have it.
We're gonna wrap it up today with favorites.
So this week's favorite is, what is your favorite movie poster / DVD cover? And I was thinking of that because I was at Best Buy the other day, and I was just looking at all the Harry. I got my
sights set on. Oh, sorry. Sorry.
The hell was that?
Just accidentally clicked my top songs playlist. Just ignore me. Sorry.
Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Sims likes Hannah Montana.
It was a complete mistake. I didn't mean to do that. Sorry.
Well, the reason why I thought of this was when I was in Best Buy and I was looking at all the DVD covers, and I thought, you know, which one's my favorite? And then, oh my god, I should use that as a favorites. So that's why I put it up. I guess we can go with what's your favorite DVD cover and what's your favorite movie poster, because there's always a lot more movie posters than DVD covers.
My favorite has to be from Chamber of Secrets. There were quite a few promo images I really liked from that movie. And I used to have the movie poster. I don't know what I did with it. But my favorite one is the one with Harry turned on his side, sort of like his body's turned to the side, but he's looking straight at the camera and he's holding the Gryffindor sword. And then Hermione's in the background with her wand up, looking ready to go. And Ron is like a little nervous, but he's also holding his wand.
Yeah. Is that for the DVD cover or the poster?
That's the poster. That's the movie poster. Sorry. It's a movie poster.
Yeah, I think I'm going to agree with Andrew. Overall, I really enjoyed all the promotional images and the DVD cover for Chamber of Secrets. I feel like after that, a lot of the promo images kind of dissolved into just generic magical type backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Whereas this, they brought more attention to the actors and their props and that kind of thing. And after that, I just felt like all the posters kind of looked the same.
Yeah. You know, which reminds me, Matt and I were in Best Buy last week and we were looking at all these and I was just thinking, like, they're all the same now. Like, yeah. It's all the same, you know, trio with the wands. Just, yeah. It's all the same.
Yeah.
Do something different.
See, that's what I want to go with Goblet of Fire here on the DVD covers, just by virtue of the fact that it has the other Triwizard Champions on it, despite the fact that they got about 20 minutes of screen time and about half a line each in the movie, but yet they were on the cover. But I still like, I like the poster a lot for that one too, in all seriousness, because the one with Harry and he's standing, it's just him and it's sort of like his back's to you and there's all this smoke and mist and it's really dark. And I think at the top it says something like, difficult times lie ahead, Harry. Do you guys know which one I'm talking mm-hmm. about?
Yeah, the teaser poster.
Yeah. I like that one a lot. It was badass. It looked like it could be on like the cover of National Geographic or something. I was all about it.
Yeah.
For posters, I mean, I would say I was a big fan of the Order of the Phoenix one with Voldemort that says, you know, you will lose everything.
Yeah.
Because I think it started to take the series in a new direction, obviously, with Order of the Phoenix sort of being the turning point. I could care less about the DVD covers, to be honest. I don't really have a preference one way or the other on the DVD covers. But I like what they started to do, and bringing up Goblet of Fire before also was a good one, where they finally started using other people besides the trio. And they're doing that with the posters for Order of the Phoenix, I think. And obviously, or hopefully, you know, Snape will be used for Half-Blood Prince. Alan Rickman.
Yeah, possibly, or something.
How about you, Matt?
Okay, let me see what we can do. Well, my favorite DVD cover, hands down, is definitely Sorcerer's Stone. Because it's very, it's almost like a hand-drawn artistic kind of look to it. And it doesn't look like it was Photoshopped like in the other DVD covers. And I like the first film DVD cover the most because it looks like a collage. I like all the things in the film. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wish that they did that with all the other ones. And let's see, my favorite poster. I agree with Andrew and Laura about their favorite being Chamber of Secrets because they did have the best in advertising. My favorite poster of that book was, or that movie was, when they have a silhouette of Dobby in the middle of the street saying Dobby has come to warn you, Harry Potter, or something.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
That was. I think that was the teaser poster for the film.
Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm. It's that poster and the Order of the Phoenix poster when they have the Death Eaters against Dumbledore's army. And they're in that fighting stance against each other.
That's actually really cool.
That is very cool.
That's my favorite poster of the film so far.
I didn't really count, like, I agree. I think that's my favorite, like, promo poster. Like, that, but that was never really a movie poster. Like, it showed up on gigantic billboards, but I think
I've seen it at, like, Hot Topics.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're talking about For Order of the Phoenix, right?
I'm talking about For Order of the Phoenix, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it is really cool. They have come up with some really cool promo images, like even with the adult actors. Like, I love the ones with Snape. Like, when they do like five posters each with a different set of characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all those are really cool. I guess that wraps up the show today. We've covered a lot. This is a long recording. It's time to remind everyone about our contact information. Laura, where do people send us gold?
That'll be P.O. Box 3151, Cumming, Georgia, 30028. No pickles.
We all- No pickles, please. Sorry, pickles not accepted, like in the commercials. You can also call the MuggleCast hotline if you want to contact us when we do voicemails occasionally. And if you're in the United States, you can dial 1-218-20-MAGIC. If you're in the United Kingdom, you can dial 020-8144-0677. And if you're in Australia, you can dial 02-8003-5668. We also have a Skype username, which is MuggleCast, if you want to contact us that way to leave a voicemail. No matter how you call us, just remember to keep your message under a minute and eliminate as much background noise as possible so you're so you sound clear and beautiful, just like all of us. We also have a handy feedback form on MuggleCast.com that you can use to contact any one of us, or just use our first name at staff.mugglenet.com, except for Matt, who's Matthew B at staff.mugglenet.com. And Elisa, if someone wants to contact you, you are Elisa at fanfiction.mugglenet.com, right?
That's correct.
Excellent. You can also visit MuggleCast.com for a variety of community outlets, including our MySpace. We got the Facebook, the YouTube, Frapper, Last.fm, and of course the forums. Elisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, you're thank a great you for part having of the show. Me.
Would you come on again?
Absolutely, of course.
Yay!
Would you come on like as much as possible?
Hell yeah!
Okay, so hell yeah!
Oh man,
hell yeah!
She must really want to.
Laura, I have some news for you.
I better be getting a severance package if that's what you're saying.
You're fired.
You're fired. I'm Andrew Sims.
Laura.
No, I'm not going to outro myself. You just fired me.
I just wanted to plug real quick a site that Laura and Elisa are maintaining. It's a new site by them. It's a political blog. It's Little Children Cover Your Ears. It's politicalbitches.com. You guys want to talk about that for a second?
Yeah, pretty much. We take the politics and we bitch about them.
Okay.
Yeah, and a little bit of informing. I recently made like a 5 million word post about Kosovo. So, but it's interesting because we cross like sailors. If that helps at all,
it's really good and it's really funny. I would not recommend it if you are not one to read adult language, but it's a very funny read. Of course,
considering
they do take
actually
a particular political stance, so some
do.
Of you will not be happy.
We're not going to lie about where we stand. It's just, it's really fun for us to do because we actually first really talked on election night of 04. So
that's
where our political relationship was fostered from.
Matt and I can attest to the fact that Laura and Elisa are hilarious to listen to when they talk politics.
I was crying. I almost choked on my Big Bacon Classic when we went to Wendy's.
I was concerned for their health.
Yeah. And I almost lost it and spit up a Frosty in the back of Elisa's car when she made a joke about being sent to Guantanamo Bay. Oh, God, that's so funny.
Surprised I'm not there already.
One of the funniest moments of my life. But Elisa, be prepared to get several hundred Facebook requests from now on. Just so you know.
Sweet.
Friend requests. Yeah.
Bring it on. Yeah. Bring it on.
It's fun. Yeah. More power to you if you want to accept them all. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this 133rd episode. I'm Andrew Sims.
I'm Laura Thompson.
I'm Mike Attanabell.
I'm Matthew Britton.
And I'm Elisa Montfort.
We'll see everyone next week for episode 134. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. It rubs the lotion on its skin or it gets the hose again.
Oh my god. Oh my god. I was just saying that to Laura and I.
Wow.
Oh my god.
I don't know what is going on.
And Andrew, edit, please.
Speaking of news,